Hey everybody, I'm Kai.
And I'm Molly, and welcome to Make Me Smart. Spart? Make Smart. Me Sparks. Spart. Welcome. Welcome to Make Me Smart, our new weekly podcast where we drill into the topics of the day and try to get you just a little smarter, try to get ourselves just a little smarter.
The formal introductions, of course, go like this. I'm Kai Ruzdahl. The name of the program is Marketplace. That's where I work. Molly Wood is Molly Wood. Tech
I also work there.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. You work there, but you also work on morning and you work on weekend and you work on tech. I mean, you do more than I do, honestly, right?
They're
and you should get the props for it. They're all Marketplace. What are we doing this week? Somebody hook me up here.
Oh my gosh, we have a fun week, you guys. For those of you who have been thinking, are you only going to talk about politics on this podcast? The answer is no. This podcast is all about business, technology, and culture. We, I think, have hit on all those things. Yes. But this week, we're going to geek out a little bit.
We're in Molly's wheelhouse.
I'm excited. Among other things, we have a guest coming up later on the program. We are talking with Tim Wu. He's a law professor at Columbia University, and he is the man who coined the phrase net neutrality all the way back in 2003 when he was talking about the future of the internet. And he has a new book out called The Attention Merchants. We're going to talk about that also.
Is it really 2003?
Isn't that crazy?
That's crazy long ago. Mm-hmm. That is but now I feel very old. also, the co-creator of the rebooted sitcom One Day at a Time, which is on Netflix, Gloria Calderon-Kellett, answers the Make Me Smart question this week for us.
Yes. If you're not familiar with the Make Me Smart, I can't.
God, what is
wrong
with
the name of our show today?
I don't know. Nothing's wrong with the name of the show, yo. It's you.
It's been raining for so many days, Kyle. I can't get
California
it together.
And it's raining. Oh, God. And
I just can't.
And you have just, like, invalidated our entire premise. But
I can't get out of bed. Like, I can't get smart because it's raining.
Ugh, California.
Anyway, we like to kick off each show by getting our little special fix.
I like this little sting. This is cool.
The news fix. It's the news fix, because we are news junkies, so we just have to like...
All right, you get to tee this one up. This one's your baby.
Well, this week it's amazing, because we just happened to have booked Tim Wu for this program. And as it happens, this is the week, really arguably the end of last week, that we are starting to see the FCC under the Trump administration take shape. So we're going to be looking at the Federal Communications Commission under Ajit Pai, who is the new commissioner. And by the way, the FCC up until this point has had a 3-2 split,
right?
Democrat to Republican. Now it's 4-1.
Right.
And so Ajit Pai has been making some bold, aggressive moves, much in the style of the president himself.
And we should say that Ajit Pai was a commissioner, right, of the FCC in the Obama administration. He was in a minority, obviously, and now he has been elevated to the chairmanship, and he is making his mark. And it's taken like 10 days, and that's it. He's moving.
Yeah, he's moving fast. You know, as with so much that's happening in this administration, a lot of it is, you could characterize the FCC under Tom Wheeler, the previous commissioner, as very consumer friendly. It was about protecting the consumer, potentially at the expense of some business. Mr. Pai is going in the opposite direction, protecting the business in the hopes that those practices will generate good outcomes for the consumer. I'm going to put that generously.
Well, and we'll get to that in a minute. Do me a favor, though, and tick off some of the things he has done in the first like 12 days, 14 days, whatever it is, of the Trump administration.
Yep. All right. So among other things, like we could say that the top three things that have happened, not even before we even get to net neutrality, are that he scrapped a program that provided federal subsidies to the poor in order to get broadband service. It's an existing program. It's been around 32 years. It didn't cover broadband until just this last year. Now, and then it gave people like a $9.75 subsidy to go toward broadband service. He got rid of that. He scrapped a program that caps the amount that prison telephone providers can charge inmates. And then he got rid of the plan that was the very controversial plan that was going to force cable companies to open up their cable boxes to other providers and basically let you have an app that would give you the Comcast guide instead of renting your box from those providers.
So before we get to net neutrality, which is in a lot of ways the nuts and bolts of this thing, all three of those items were entirely predictable in a GOP administration, right? Do we have to kind of stipulate that?
To some extent, I mean I think it's called the Lifeline program,
the broadband subsidy was
a pre-existing and fairly bipartisan program before it was expanded to include broadband. So But in keeping with the idea, you know, the GOP argument has been that the Obama administration and Tom Wheeler overreached,
yeah.
and that one, you know, that they that he rammed a lot of these things down the throats of the commission. And so,
which in fairness, he kind of did, right? I mean, he took his 3-2 majority and he ran with it.
Yep. He absolutely did, yeah. and that is part of the reason that Republicans are so incensed, right. in particular about net neutrality, the Title II reclassification, which we'll get to next. Now, he has not immediately talked about how he's going to handle the broad sort of regulatory framework of net right. neutrality, but he did immediately stop investigations into what's called zero rating, which is mobile wireless providers that give free access. It doesn't count against your data cap if you stream certain
programs. Give me a real-life example of zero rating, and then I want to get to net neutrality.
If you have heard of, like, the T-Mobile Binge On program,
yes,
T-Mobile
I have.
Started this whole thing.
Yep.
They give you free... So if you stream, let's say, Netflix, Spotify, Pandora, or YouTube,
mm-hmm.
those don't count against your data cap. Those services.
So that is that's the nut of
and that
zero
is
rating.
Called zero right. Okay. So that is when a wireless provider decides you can have access to certain services and that will not count against your data cap,
uh-huh.
they're zero rating those services.
Okay.
And that in this case is entertainment. In the case of Facebook in India, right? It was Facebook and a couple of different websites.
Right. How come it's bad to have zero rating?
Well, so this is what Ajit Pai said, which is we're not going to come after T-Mobile. Now, Verizon's jumped on board, AT&T. They mm-hmm. all have different services that they're streaming for free. And Ajit Pai said, consumers love that.
And we do. I'm a consumer.
Sure. But what if you're trying to build the next Hulu or the next YouTube?
That's not
or the
problem,
next title.
I want what I want when I want it. I'm a mobile right. consumer in America in the 21st century.
Yeah. And so you can, turns out, well, good for you. You can have it. Where it gets a little dicey is, let's say, the example of, I mean, it gets a little dicey if your argument is that there may be a competing service that is trying to get traction with consumers and innovate in some way and offer them a better service. Like, there could be a better YouTube out there, but you might never know because you're busy getting YouTube for free on T-Mobile. And that better YouTube won't ever go anywhere.
Bring it back home for me here and fold this into the larger net neutrality argument, right? And first of all, let's explain net neutrality in, you know, 2.5 sentences. Go.
Wait. I'm looking up. You have this, too. I mean, the idea of net neutrality, basically, you know this. Come on. Stop asking
I
questions
this.
Like
it's,
we're on the radio.
Okay. All right. Let's explain, Molly, what net neutrality is.
Net neutrality is the idea that you, the consumer, or you, the provider, have to treat equally all of the things that go over your pipes. You cannot yep. discriminate or block them for business reasons or content reasons or any other reason. And that if I'm the consumer and I pay for to access those sites, I have a reasonable expectation that I will get that they will all be treated equally.
Which I totally love, and I think that's great. But if I'm Brian Roberts running Comcast, right,
mm-hmm.
also owning Universal and all that content and all that jazz, they're my pipes, man. Why can't I do with them what I want? And charge mm-hmm. what I want and let the market forces rule. Because let's remember, we are in a GOP administration here.
I know. I'm having this amazing flashback to, like, I think 2004, maybe, or 2005, when we first started talking about net neutrality on a little podcast called Buzz Out Loud.
Yeah.
And the Ed Whiteacre, then mm-hmm. of...
AT&T,
what was
right?
It was AT&T before it was AT&T, the Bell,
yeah,
Southeastern Bell,
know.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
He is the guy who basically said, whoa. I'm providing these pipes, and you're paying to download stuff, but the company should be paying me, too. It's my pipe. I can do whatever I want with it.
So I've taken us back 14 years.
I guess the counterargument is you can protect your... So what they have said is, look, everything that we've done has been in service of protecting our network so that we can ultimately provide a better service.
Yeah.
It gets a little fuzzy, though, and this is what everybody was really concerned about when the net neutrality debate first started, when they own the content.
Right, which they didn't do 15 years ago, but now, as I just said, Comcast and Universal and all of that jazz.
Right, so they own all of that, and then they've got this big competitor in, let's say, Netflix, in Hulu, in YouTube. And so consumers and regulators said, we need some safeguards to ensure that they don't prioritize their own content over these other sites. Now, the number of examples of this happening, like, this was something we were really worried about for a really long time. There have not been wide spread violations of net neutrality and discrimination. Most of what has occurred have been like traffic shaping behind the scenes. They promise you certain speeds and they don't deliver them.
Right. And they get prosecuted for that. They get fined and all that jazz, right? Somebody was just fined like $100 million or something, right?
AT&T got fined $100 million for advertising unlimited plans that then throttled. But, you know, now we're getting into it with wireless networks. Sprint just bought a portion of Tidal. That would be the first time that they start to zero rate.
The music service, right?
Tidal, the failing music service. Sad.
Which is a whole different podcast. All right, I'm just going to state this as a matter of opinion. I actually believe that what we ought to do in this country is regulate the internet like a utility. Regulate it like power lines, regulate it like coal plants, regulate it like whatever you have, because it is that essential to the functioning of this modern economy. And what happens when you regulate those things as public utilities is there are guaranteed profit margins, there is very strict supervision, and you take it out of the hands, really, of true for-profit free market companies. Mm-hmm. Where do you fall on that discussion?
Well, that's what Tom Wheeler said, and this whole time you've been arguing for the Ajit Pai side.
Well, somebody, I mean, come on, man. Everybody
I'm so
gets
confused.
Equal time.
You know, it's really interesting because I think a lot of like people in the tech industry felt concerned when Wheeler went all the way to reclassifying the internet as basically a utility because, you know, you can't say that there's been a ton of innovation on the electricity grid or that the system of federal highways isn't falling apart. Like the internet, in addition to being possibly the most powerful communications tool ever, is a huge, like a land of untapped potential when it comes to innovation and ideas and business opportunities. And so if you regulate it and you do all those things and you say this is the amount of profit you can make and this is the – and you stop some of that from happening. You stop that innovation potentially. And so it feels kind of nuclear.
It kind of does because it's a big deal, right? But you could totally make the case that straight unfettered for-profit businesses have different incentives in their running of this thing that is so vital, right?
Yeah, I agree. The thing that concerns me the most, actually, about the direction we are now headed with the FCC is that we are stripping away consumer protection at the same time that we are likely to reduce competition. Like the biggest problem in the broadband market has been a lack of competition. Most regions, you know, for years had essentially monopolies. In fact, like Charter in New York just got sued last week over providing far slower speeds than it advertised. Charter bought Time Warner in May, and Time Warner has been effectively the only broadband provider in that region. And the FCC, it should be noted, is also going to be in charge of approving mergers between companies that have a telecom operation. And so those companies right now are just drooling. We're talking about Charter and Verizon.
Right.
There's been rumors that Verizon and Comcast might try to get together. So if we have a weakening of consumer protection at the same time as we have like a frickin' media merger bonanza, then I don't think innovation wins in that environment.
And it should be said, Ajit Pai used to be a lawyer at Verizon. Just saying.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
So our real question, and we're going to put this to Tim Wu in about 2 seconds here, is have businesses been good stewards, right, of the internet, the world's most valuable communications platform? And is there reason to think that they will be in the future?
We're going to get there in a minute. First, though, I'm going to say this. She is at Molly Wood on Twitter. I am at Kai Rizdahl. The hashtag we would love for you to use would be
make me
smart. The hashtag is make me smart, and we'll find it and we'll poke around and we'll do all kinds of good stuff online because it's not me. It's not Molly. It's you guys. So I had a chance the other day to talk to Norman Lear, who we had on the podcast a week ago. Today, his producing partner in their reboot of the 1970s sitcom One Day at a Time. Her name is Gloria Calderon Kellett, and we asked her the Make Me Smart question, which was, what is something you thought you once knew, but it turns out and you found out you were wrong about it? Here's what she said.
I think this election is actually the perfect example. I had all my female writers over to my home. I had champagne bottles. I took my daughter with me to the polls and told her I'm voting for the first woman president, I was very much in an echo chamber of what other people think and feel on my Facebook and on my social media is reflective of what I think and feel. And so I was definitely guilty of not knowing everything that was happening in this country. And that's shameful. I need to be reading more. I need to understand more about what other people are going through and how best to communicate with them and understand them so that we can come to more of a, basically try to bring together this divide.
Hmm. It's so hard.
Oh,
right?
The bubble. It's so hard. And it's, you know, this is sort of a whole thread through, I think, this particular episode, like as we talk about this idea of the world's most important communication platform and all of the things that are trying to grab our attention. That's what, you know, Tim Wu's got a book about. And we're going to be talking about that, this conscious effort to look outside your bubble and whether it's even possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it totally is. And because and we had this on the first episode. It was, what do you want other people to know about you, right? That was one of the sort of listener questions that we asked. And it's the same basic principle. We want to hear from you on this one. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Send us a little recording if you want. We've got that full interview with Gloria Calderon-Kellett and Norman Lear. It's at marketplace.org.
Next up, Tim Wu. After, somewhat appropriately, we pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. The shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
And here is Tim Wu. Just a reminder, he's a law professor at Columbia Law School, best known, at least among our fans, for coining the phrase net neutrality in 2003. He specializes in competition, copyright, and telecommunications law, and is the author of, most recently, The Attention Merchants, released this past October, which couldn't be more timely. It's essentially a history of how advertisers and masters of political propaganda learned to grab our attention and get our support for everything from toothpaste to presidents. Tim, thank you for coming on the program.
Sure. Great. Glad to be here.
So Tim, Molly pointed out up top that you were the guy who is commonly credited with coming up with the phrase net neutrality like 13 something years ago. What were you thinking? What was your mindset?
Oh, well, I thought, you know, alliteration would work. I mean, the concept had been around. I mean, it was that low. You know, the concept had been kind of around that maybe we need to think about the carriers, the phone companies and cable and, you know, when they got to the internet, what they would do with it. And I just wrote a paper and I was like, well, maybe they need to be neutral in how they treat stuff. And I was like looking around. My original phrase was inter-network neutrality. That didn't really catch on. And then I came up with network neutrality and then net neutrality. The other term I had was broadband discrimination. And I didn't know which was going to catch on. And somehow, these things, you can't control language. And that's what caught on somehow.
What are you thinking as you watch this sort of new FCC address zero rating, maybe talk about overturning Title II reclassification? Where's your mindset about the future right now?
Well, I'm not completely surprised. Pai made one of his trademark ideas to be against net neutrality regulation. Actually, he sometimes said he likes net neutrality as a principle, but doesn't think there should be any enforcement of it. That's kind of things people say sometimes to be polite, I guess, in a sense, because the underlying idea of net neutrality is very, very popular. And this gets to my comment, is I think it may end up being a little harder than it looks.
Yeah.
It's not like
you mean unpacking what's been done so far.
Yeah, undoing net neutrality, Reversing the regulation may be harder than it looks. And I'm not sure it's within PI's power in the short term. You know, I don't want to get into the legal reason, but basically when an agency does something, it's not that easy a year later to 2 years later to undo it unless you have a reason.
So I want to go back to zero rating just for a second, only because at the top of the show, Kai said he didn't think that zero rating sounded like such a big deal.
What? Ouch, snap. But hey, love you too, Molly Mann.
What do you think, Tim?
Well, I think it's the end of life?
Wait, let me characterize what I said. Why can't I do what I want with my pipes, is in essence what I was saying.
That's the same thing in all of net neutrality. You know, why not let Comcast block the New York Times if they want to do a deal with Bloomberg or something? You know, it has to do with whether you think there's certain parts of the nation's infrastructure that should be somewhat neutral, that should, you know, carry content equally. You know, the phone networks, just to take a classic example, you're not allowed to block some people from calling other people. They have to be open. The electric networks, you can plug in any appliance. Question has always been, should the internet be the same? And sure, there are owners, but they're owners of what is essentially a public calling, a public kind of business. And it's been like that for hundreds of years, or at least 150 years. And I think it's something that's been very good for the economy and for the culture of the United States.
Let me get a listener question in here. A guy by the name of Les Krauss wrote, and he wants to know if you could give us a sense of the winners and losers as policies toward net neutrality change in this administration.
So in terms of the private sector?
Yeah.
I mean, the winners are unquestionably the cable companies and the phone companies and their wireless versions, in the sense that they have the opportunity to go around to all these internet companies. If net neutrality starts to fade and be like, hey, give us more money or we're going to mess with you, you know, kind of Tony Soprano business model. That looks good for them. There is a chance that some of the big internet companies end up being winners in a certain sense. If they cut a sweetheart deal, let's say Google or Facebook cut a big sweetheart deal with Comcast, then it becomes even harder to compete with them. You know, if you're poor little DuckDuckGo or some other search engine, and now Google not only is Google, but they also now have this deal with Comcast, Charter, and, you know, the other big phone companies and broadband companies. It's like, wow, that's even harder to get started. So they are also potentially winners. It kind of depends. Yeah, so basically good for the big guys, bad for diversity of speech, bad for innovation, bad for a dynamic economy. That's my bottom line. Bad for entrepreneurs. Very bad for entrepreneurs, in the sense that, you know, the internet has fostered a huge amount of entrepreneurism based on the idea you write an app or you write a program and you just reach people over the internet. Well, what if it's now you have to sort of make a deal with Comcast, and Comcast is already friends with Google, so Google says, no, don't do that deal with them. It gets a lot more difficult when you have motivated private owners of the public infrastructure. Hmm. So I think it's terrible, but that's, of course, I do.
I like it, though. That's a good summation. Let's talk about your book, which I think, you know, that sounds like an awkward transition, but we're really talking about the power of communication. Exactly. I think it's all really of a piece. And like I said, this book couldn't be more timely. The Attention Merchants, it is, our producer described it as a high-speed chase, which I think it kind of is, of the history of almost 200 years of advertising and entertainment and political and technological influence seekers. What made you tackle this topic? And did you know it was going to turn out to be so timely?
No, you know, I didn't. You know, great question. A mixture of academic and personal reasons. Personally, I had these experiences where I started noticing that I was losing control of my own attention. You know, I would sit down to write an email and all of a sudden, like, 2 hours go by. Yep. What just happened?
Yep.
You know, and I was like, something weird is going on here. And I kind of wanted to understand what was going on. And understand the attention economy better. I don't think we have a good feeling for it. So I'm the kind of person who is all about going to the beginning of the Nile to, you know, find the source of the Nile. I wanted to see where it all started. So that led me back to the early, I wanted to see, where does this business model come from where you gather a crowd and resell their attention?
Yeah.
It led me back to tabloid newspapers in the 1830s. And you know, it's a high-speed chase of just trying to get our, you know, minds and eyes focused on things for even tiny bits of time and make money off that.
It's so funny because, you know, tiny bits of time, which is what our attention is sliced up into now. This idea of attention as a commodity mm-hmm. is not a new thing, as you point out.
No, it's not. Broadcast television completely depended on the attention of viewers to make money. I pointed out newspapers. So it's new in the grand scheme of things. You know, it's not like thousands of years old, but it's old in the terms of our generation, where we think anything older than a year is old. So, So it's in that sense. But there actually, I point out in the book, there is a even further tradition associated with religion and religious organizations mm-hmm. wanting to have people have rituals where they pray every day or go to church on Sundays or keep certain times like the Sabbath, you know, as sacred for them. These days, we have prime time. You have, we got to check into Facebook. You know, every day, if you don't go to Facebook every day, it's like a form of sin, or at least to Facebook. So, you know, there's direct links between organized religion and the copying of those techniques, which are in the book. So it's a longer history in that sense.
Yeah. And political propaganda and all of it. You also point out that, you know, as sort of like, as the realization that religious and political propaganda are things that can grab people's attention, and that starts to get applied to advertising, you talk about how economic survival depends on grabbing the attention of more and more and more people mm-hmm. and becomes a race to the bottom in some ways. So I guess the question is like the same as every kid in the backseat. Are we there yet? Are we at the bottom?
Yeah. Oh, I think in many ways we are at the bottom. You know, these things go through peaks and valleys, and I think we can come back. But right now we're at a very, very low moment. You know, we're at kind of where newspapers were at their worst during the heyday of fake news. The real heyday of fake news is in the 1830s. In fact, the book opens with the very first so-called free or penny newspaper struggling mm-hmm. and deciding that the key to solving all its problems is publishing stories about life on the moon, which ultimately leads to the discovery of man bats on the moon who are
the man bat thing wasn't that just there was a hole that was in the U.S. World News Report, right? There was a bat boy, like that whole long bat boy thing in the early 90s or something, and I was like, oh my god, it came from that penny paper, the New York Sun. That blew my mind,
which was fake news. I mean, fake news, you talk about races to the bottom. A good sign that you're in a race to the bottom is a proliferation of fake news and a loss of veracity in pervasive media. And so I think that's a pretty good warning sign. We've been here before. You know, every so often you get to fake news. And totalitarian regimes are full of fake news. I mean, it's just like the authority says what the news is, and you never figure out what's right or wrong. Soviet Union, Nazi Germany. The fact that, we're in that phase right now is, to me, a big warning sign.
Do you look at it and go, man, could have told you this was coming?
You know, if my book is successful, it foretells. If I'd been a genius, I would have, written this, but it foretells that there will arise a lord of the attention merchants who uses the techniques of commercial media, of celebrity, reality television, and of sort of pervasive social media, which can jump over the media and reach people directly, like Twitter, and uses that as a device towards accumulating political power, and therefore transforming politics as we know it into a part of the entertainment industry. every sort of factor is there to predict the rise of Trump, but the opportunity is just sitting there. And I sense that someone could grab it. I wasn't smart enough to think it would be him, because I, like many other people, kind of think he's incompetent, but he's not incompetent at what it counts, which is he is winning. Look, here we are again talking about him. He wins every attentional battle.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you're just keeping score ratings-wise, he is the winner of the, all-time. You know, you go to other countries, people are talking about him. So if you care about good results or you care about popularity, that not a winner. But just pure ratings, attention, amount of time focused on some person, he is the king of all attention merchants.
Okay, but Tim, you also talk, as you sort of explore the cyclical nature, right, of this attention peddling and attention grabbing. You talk a lot about the backlash against the Charest posters and the backlash against excessive mm-hmm. advertising and the extent to which we're even seeing that now with ad blockers. You know, if you could predict our sort of next backlash, are we there? Is that this sort of protest economy that we're starting to see?
I will tell you the grounds are all there. Now, if you look at the long length of time, attentional strategies, immersive, intrusive, intentional strategies, the one great hope is they eventually lead to a massive kind of backlash where people have had it. They can't stand anymore just being subjected to intentional manipulation and control. And I believe, there is the possibility of a real rejection of the ways we are gaining information right now and people moving away en masse to something different. I don't know exactly what that would be. And it's not going to be easy, but, almost a mass ignoring. And, and I think that I'll tell you that the current president's greatest fear is not losing, but being ignored. Mm-hmm. And it'll be a vast tuning out of just the nonsense, and that in a really strange, almost like mythical way would rob this presidency of its power.
That's so interesting, though, because that requires, while the president only is one guy who has to do his own thing, the collective ignoring is a collective exercise of will communally by millions and millions of people.
Be very, very challenging, and I, as much as anyone, can't resist, what absurd thing just happened today. Mm-hmm. But people got sick of Jersey Shore eventually, right?
It happens. Well, there's
if you live by attention, you die by attention. And believe it or not, it's the source of this presidency's power. And it, those are the seeds of it, of some of this downfall. So I also think that there's some real opportunity for people to rethink the web and other public media and what we want for it. I think subscription models are on the rise, ad-free models on the rise. People are starting to understand if you want good content, you actually have to pay for it. And I believe there's a potential for another golden age for the web and other internet content, and like there is with TV, where there's just enough money to go around for a lot of great stuff. So I'm actually optimistic, but I think we're in a very dark place right now.
Here's hoping. Tim Wu, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So here's the thing about talking to people like Tim Wu. I feel like such an underachiever. I mean, the guy's at freaking Columbia. He's writing a book. He's on the staff writer of The New Yorker. And I'm sitting here like talking my native tongue into the microphone. Honestly, that's the way I feel.
I often feel that way. Yeah. But I am going to tell you something that a really smart person told me, which is that sometimes when you're really, really, really good at a thing, it doesn't feel hard. And it's confusing because it makes you think that it's not very important. But the fact is, what you do is super hard for other people. And I agree. I am completely brain flummoxed by Tim Wu. Yeah. But you're awesome, Kai.
Oh, look,
we're great at this.
A therapy session in a podcast. It's amazing. Oh, man. If you have thoughts about Tim Wu, about my psychic needs, about anything, email us makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bodner, and our senior producer, Nancy Fergali. This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. And this is my favorite part of the show, you guys. Our theme music is composed in the house by Ben Holliday and Daniel Ramirez.
Right in the studio right next door. The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves. The general... she's my boss's boss, and I can't even get her name right. Senior Vice President and General Manager is Deborah Clark.
We're Molly Wood and Kai Rizdahl, case you forgot.
Do we have to say that? I guess we do.
No, I just decided to throw it in there. Going off script.
Holy cow, man.
Doing what I want.
It's a podcast. You can do whatever you want.
I remember who we are.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.